The Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies presents the Pearl of Great Price Lecture Series, given by Dr. Hugh Nibley. Today's lecture is entitled, The Pearl of Great Price on the Plurality of Worlds.
So look at Abraham 131 here. Now this is on this subject of plurality of worlds we were talking about. How does the Pearl of Great Price treat it? And so we get the first chapter of Abraham, that vitally important first chapter of Abraham here. And what does he say in the 31st verse? Yes. Yes, now notice the gospel, as far as he concerns, takes in a lot of things, the things we have been talking about. He has a record of his fathers, the patriarchs. These things have always been recorded and always been marked down and always been studied where the gospel is. The records of the fathers, the patriarchs, concerning the right of the priesthood, the Lord my God preserved in mine own hand. So he has the record. With his authority to carry on, he must have the record. Therefore, what do these records contain? Notice, therefore, a knowledge of the beginning of the creation and also of the planets and the stars, they're relevant. They come into the picture. As they were made known unto the Father. So this has always been part of the tradition in the gospel. To know where we are, to know what the setting is, to know what the plot is. Remember, what is the scenario? What are we supposed to be doing? This is the theme. The fathers were given this. And I have kept even unto this day, I shall endeavor to write some of these things upon this record for the benefit of my posterity. So he is handing it on. Then, I should have gone first to Moses 1. Moses 1 is very good here, as you know. Fourth and fifth verses here. Behold, thou art my son. Notice it's handed on to a legitimate heir. This knowledge and information is handed on. Thou art my son, wherefore look. He's going to be shown. He's going to see it. Not in the mind's eye, Horatio. He's going to see it. The Lord is showing it to him. And I will show thee the workmanship of my hands, but not all, for my works without end. That's going to be of extreme importance presently. And also my words, for they never cease. Wherefore, no man can behold all my works, except he behold all my glory, and no man can behold all my glory, and afterwards remain in the flesh. So here we have a big scene. We're only going to be shown a small part of it, but it's the real part. He says, look, and I'll show it to you, but I won't show it all to you, because it's without end, and you can't see that now. So we're being set into a much larger picture here. And then in the Moses, in the 33rd verse of this same chapter, goes on, worlds without number have I created. That's a basic principle of the gospel. And I also created them for my own purpose. They don't concern us now. We'll see. Notice he says at two verses above, for my own purpose have I made these things. Here is wisdom, and it remaineth in me. When Moses wanted to know about the whole thing, he says, oh no, not this. You're just going to have to limit yourself to the small scope that you can comprehend. And then he says in the 35th verse, but only an account of this earth. This is all you can handle. But we're supposed to have it, but we must know its setting. I mean, to understand that, to know what sort of a place Europe is to live in, you have to know about the other continents. It's by sailing across the ocean that they discover the nature of their own planet, of their own community, and their own continent. Only an account of this earth and the inhabitants thereof give I unto you, for there are many worlds, important thing to know, that have passed away by the word of my power. And there are many that now stand, innumerable are they unto men. The ones that stand now, the new findings on this have been absolutely staggering, haven't they? But all things are numbered unto me, for they are mine, and I know them. And then in the 37th verse, and the Lord God spake unto Moses, saying, the heavens, they are many, they cannot be numbered. Heavens in the plural here, in the galaxy far away. And they are numbered unto me, for they are mine. And as one earth, here's the process, the local systems, there are local systems and larger systems. I should have brought the map along, but I'll do it the next time. As one earth shall pass away and the heavens thereof, even so shall another come, and there is no end to my works or to my world. And the whole thing is to bring forth, to pass the immortality and eternal life of, and to involve, to let us hack in on the system, to let us get in on this thing of the eternities. Of course, it's a grandiose conception. Can you do anything to prove it one way or the other? Well, then, let's look at the, 36th verse is important. We skipped that one. Oh God, oh yes, he says, notice, Moses is going to settle for this. We're going to have to settle for this. And Moses said, oh God, be merciful unto thy servant and tell me concerning this earth and the inhabitants thereof, and also the heavens, and then thy servants shall be content. You notice the heavens are in the plural, used all the time in the plural. It's dealing with systems. We talk about galaxies and systems now. There isn't just, again, you see, this is a complete refutation of the old idea that the earth was the center of the universe and the heaven was everything that revolved around it. Because the heaven, there were the seven heavens. The heavens are something different this time. Every world belongs to its particular system and has its particular heavens. They're always mentioned together. And so he says, tell me concerning this earth, and then thy servant will be content. First lesson he had to learn. The 27th verse of this same chapter. Moses cast his eyes and beheld the earth. Yea, even all of it. That he could see, all of it, every particle. Notice we're dealing with particles. Particle physics is very important today. Did he say, you mean he counted every particle, every molecule? Well, we'd say if he saw every particle, he saw every class. He saw every particle of which it was composed. He saw the quarks, and he saw the protons, and he saw the neutrons and all these things. And if he knew all the particles, then he knew of what the earth was composed. I don't think he had to count all the protons and all the neutrons, especially since they're changing into each other constantly all the time. But he did see that there were particles, and he saw them all. And here in the 27th verse, he's told that. Not a particle of it which he did not behold, discerning it by the Spirit of God. And then the next verse, he beheld also the inhabitants thereof. There was not a soul, yet he beheld not. And he discerned them by the Spirit of God, and their numbers were great, even numberless as the sands on the seashore. Now this is used constantly in Oriental writings, used many times. The Egyptians use it. I was just reading a text, and he talks about, it talks about Joseph. He supplied the people with grain, and it says, well, in Genesis it says the same thing. In the 37th chapter of Genesis, he says, he provided grain for the people as numerous as the sands of the seashore, sands of a sandbank, that it could not be numbered, very great. It goes on this way, and using the same expression, applied to grain. Anything you can't count, you see. Can you count the sands of the seashore? No, well, that's how many there is. If it's beyond counting, that is the standard expression for that. I know people who say, if you count the sands of the seashore, every one of them, that last one represents the last world or the last person, you see, because that's exactly how many souls there are, as many as there are grains of sand, which is rather silly. What's the next verse say? And there were many lands, and each land was called earth. That was the inhabitants. Again, you see, the earth is divided into different lands. All right, see the word earth is arets, and the word land is arets. So you're going to use the very same word for all of them, because they're separate communities, separate worlds. When I was a little kid, it was darkest Africa, and most of Africa was unknown. Most of it wasn't until the 1920s that Sir Arl Stein and it went into Central Asia, and Nicholas, what's his name, and his son. Wait a minute, they were the first to enter. That was many years ago, but. Central Asia was unknown, Africa was unknown, the Arctic has never been discovered. We always used to get so excited about Perry, who went to the pole, and they had the big fight, you know. Did Perry get to the pole first? And the trouble with Shackleton and Scott and all the rest. Those were all in my days. Nobody had ever been to the poles. The islands of the sea, many were still undiscovered. Most of Africa was unknown, most of Asia was unknown, imagine that. Each was a separate land, a separate community. For years and years they didn't know anything of each other. There's a collection, quite a collection of writers, of early Jewish writers, who looked people like Nathan Habavli. Way back in the 9th century, he was a great traveler. He was born in Abyssinia among a Jewish community there, and he traveled all over Asia, locating and taking notes on and interviewing people who might be members of the 10 tribes. And he got 10 tribe notices all over the place. Well, there are many people like that. There's a very notable one who went to America for that purpose. He had to go much later. He went in the 17th century, 1640. And that was Antonio Montezina, who is a famous Jewish traveler, and he said he found, not the 10 tribes, he said, but he found small Hebrew-speaking enclaves. They didn't speak it, he says, but they recalled it. They had phrases and uses, and they were Jewish in their practices and so forth, all along the Cordilleras in Central America, and he went into Ecuador. And he was one of the first to go into many areas there. So there were lots of earths, lots of separate lands. You're thinking of it that way. Not the same anymore. Of course, it's one globe. It's one world now. And then Moses calls on God, and he says, tell me why this all is. And God says, I won't tell you why it is. It's none of your business yet. Tell me why these things are so, and by what thou madest them. We used to talk about that as the epic question, you see. When the epic situation is stated, the first few lines of every epic poem, the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Aeneid, and so forth. Then you begin, "Tis starts with their own 13, Peridine, Mahasai," and so forth. Why did this? Why was all this? Tell me, Muse, Muhumisi, in the Odyssey, tell me why this was. And Aeneid, the same thing, why a man of such piety should be driven so far. Quo numen laeso, insignem pietate virum tata dira laboris, why such a man of such noble piety would have to go through such labors. There's the introduction, the first 10 lines or so of an epic, and then the poet asks the question of the muse, as Milton does in Paradise Lost. You know, he says, "Say first, for thou was present and with sheltering wings out from, tell me how this first happened, how our first parents sinned, and whose bitter fruit brought death into the world and all that, and tempted to that vile revolt, or tempted by that, to that vile, why did it all happen?" He's going to ask the muse to tell him what's going on, and this is the epic question, and Moses asks it here. I mean, when a great panorama is spread before your eyes, the first thing you say, "What's it all about? Can you explain to me what I'm looking at? This is a noble prospect. Tell me all about it. Summarize the gospel in 2 sentences, see?" And the person is always rebuked. "You can't do it in that short period." And the epic usually runs to 1,000 pages or so that follows that, dealing with just an episode or two. But here he says, "Tell me why these things are so, and by what thou madest. How did you ever do it, and why?" This is quite a question. God said, "I'm not going to answer that now." "The glory of the Lord was upon Moses. He stood in his presence and talked with him face to face. And the Lord said unto Moses, a good question, but for mine own purposes have I made these things. Here is wisdom, and it remaineth in me. You'll have to be content with your world. That's all you can handle now." And then Moses says, "Yes, thy servant will be content." Then in the 40th verse we have here, "Yes, and now, Moses, my son, I will speak unto thee concerning this earth upon which thou standest, and thou shalt write the things which I shall speak." And then the first verse of the next chapter, "Behold, I reveal unto you concerning this heaven and this earth, this system. I am confining you to a particular system. Write the words which I speak. I am the beginning," and then he starts out that. So we are having a multiplicity of worlds, and we're limited in our view. Turn to the 7th chapter now. That's a very important one here on the same subject, where Enoch is the enlightener. And the 36th verse. That's well along here. "Wherefore I can stretch forth mine hands and hold all the creations which I have made, and mine eye can pierce them also among all the workmanship of my hand." Notice the use of the word hands. He's not going to hold a red giant or a white dwarf even in his hand. Nobody does that sort of thing. You know what that means. "I can stretch forth mine hands and hold all the creations which I have made, and mine eye can pierce them also, and among all the workmanship of my hands there has not been so great wickedness as among thy brethren." Now, that is quite a recommendation for this world we live on. But anyway, "Satan shall be their father, and misery shall be their doom. And the whole heavens," see, there are other heavens, other worlds, "weep for them." It's not just the earth that goes, but "the whole heavens shall weep for them, even all the workmanship of my hands." Again, this is another grandiose concept that you'll find in modern times. First, in the Pearl of Great Price, the idea is that all the worlds contribute when a new world is to be made. Everybody wants to make his contribution and have a share in it and so forth. It's of interest to everyone. Everyone is concerned. We're in a state of quarantine here, so we don't know about these things. Remember, the veil is dropped for us. But he tells us here that all the heavens, all his workmanship, he says, "The workmanship of my hand has no end. It all weeps to see one world destroyed." We have some literature on that, which I may mention. We'll take at least one hour for the creation. That's going to have to take that, because that's the thing that must be accounted for. There are questions, see, that come up, basic questions that have to be answered, questions of time, questions of scope. That is not taken, those questions are not taken care of in the Bible, or in a lot of theological writing. But at any rate, he's talking about a lot of things going on out there that are not confined just to this earth. "Shall not the heavens weep, seeing that these shall suffer?" And he says he's prepared for them and so forth. Then in the 40th verse he says here, "Wherefore, for this shall the heavens weep, yea, and all the workmanship of my hands." They not only exist without number, but they're all connected. They're all associated with each other. There are connections and understandings between them. I'll mention that a little later. Well, and of course the facsimile, the explanation to facsimile numbered figures 1, 2, and 5. Assume, if you turn to your facsimile, which is off opposite page 35 here in your, in Ulster, Pearls of Great Price, I think. You notice first, here's the first creation nearest to the celestial. That means there are other creations, first in government, one day to a cubit. Notice there are measurements of time. Things are measured, things are timed, things are spaced. Everything has structure here. And figure number two, next to Cullum. The key to the power also pertained to other planets, as revealed by God to Abraham. And this, the next grand governing creation near to the celestial. We're getting a hierarchy here. And then the fifth one, Egyptian. And this is borrowing. One is borrowing from the other. Though there are governing powers, there are powers. It's what has happened here is energy is being swapped around here. Notice the governing power, the 16th. This planet receives its power through the medium of others who transmit the power to others, and so it goes. What we have is a system here. We're not studying it now. We're just mentioning the fact we do believe in a plurality of worlds, and the Book of Abraham insists on it. And notice in the third chapter, in the verses 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 9, yeah, that makes in six times, or oh, seven times, he repeats, two, yes, back in 3, 2, 3, 6, 7, 9, he repeats, you must always understand what you're seeing in terms of the earth on which thou standest, from where you view it. You don't see things from above or from the with the eye of God that embraces all things at once. You have a limited point of view, and that's going to restrict you. So throughout that third chapter, you notice, he says, you notice here, I saw the stars, there were many, and there was one nearest to the throne of God. There's a multitude of things. And then he says here, I have set this one to govern all those belonging to the same order upon which thou standest. So Abraham lives on a particular order that belongs to a particular star. We know the sun is a particular kind of star of a particular order. And this is the order to which Abraham belongs where he stands at present. This is where he is now, and he says, everything has to be seen from that point of view. In the next verse, you notice, this manner of reckoning, 1,000 years, according to the time of your order, not to any other, you see, under that order whereon thou standest. And the next verse, he says, this planet is lesser light, even the day and the night, greater than that upon which thou standest. Here's a planet greater than that upon which thou standest. Again, the earth upon which thou standest, well, it's referred to twice, you see. This formula is used, the earth upon which thou standest. It's used twice here. And so it's used seven times in this one chapter. Always specifies all your reckonings and all your views and your pictures of the universe are only what can be seen from the place where you're standing. And this, of course, is a very important principle today. It's the anthropic principle. It's become absolutely basic in astronomy in the last 10 years or so. It's new and it's extremely important. Seventh verse, reckoning of time of the earth upon which thou standest. Again, the ninth verse, Cullum is set nigh unto the throne of God to govern those planets which belong to the same order as that. You notice, Cullum doesn't govern all the planets in the universe, only those of the same order that concern Abraham. So he's shown Cullum for that purpose because it concerns him. Well, then 3, 11 and 12 here, talked to him face to face, and he told me of the works which his hands had made, and he said to me, he stretched forth his hand, I'll show you all these, and he put his hand upon mine eyes, those things which his hand had made, which were many, the same hand that had made all these things, and they multiplied before my eyes, and I could not see the end thereof. They really make it very plain here what the situation is. And then the 13th verse talks about Abraham's local system. This is Shinahav, which means in Egyptian one eternal rhyme. Shinahav means to go around forever, which is the sun, which is what the Egyptians call it, of course. And he said to me, Kalkab, that's Hebrew word for a star. It's a very interesting word. Nobody knows what it is. Same as the Babylonian word. And he said unto me, well, Arabic word also, Kalkabun Kawakibu, which is the plural of Kawakib in Arabic. Kalkabim, that which is the plural of Hebrew, which signifies stars or great lights, which were the firmament in the firmament of heaven. And the firmament of heaven. So here we're getting local systems and all the rest of it. And then we're told about the council. Oh, I forgot to tell you. Anyway. So in verses 21 to 28 of this same chapter, where they get together and start making things. We're talking about plurality now, not about the creation. Now, oh yes, we were talking about those things. I want to mention just a few things here. We hadn't come to the end of it quite yet. And this is the point here, and it's a very important thing, namely, and to wit, For some strange reason, which would be obvious, it's been commonly held that the mere idea that there are other worlds or planets, other worlds or other people beside this, and that there are other worlds greater and that our sun is a small star and so forth, that would wipe out the whole foundation of Christianity and Judaism. In fact, it would wipe out the whole foundation of religion if we once discovered that there were other planets. That has been commonly held by scientists and churchmen alike for the obvious reason, to begin with, their definition of creation. Creation is just once for all everything out of nothing. Well, there's a lot of things to be counted for. Now, here is philosopher Bayet, says, 1954, he sees the plurality of worlds. What a mockery of human design. What an annihilation of human vanities. As soon as we discover, see, a plurality of worlds, he says, is a mockery of human design. What we do here is nothing. If you wanted eloquent passages on the subject, all he'd have to do is go to early Christian literature. It tells us in the Dead Sea Scrolls, as a matter of fact, that, it's in a Coptic writing, a Christian writing, that when you approach the throne of God, he says, the sun is as small as a grain of flour. It's absolutely lost. It disappears in the multitude of stars, it says. And it looks about the size of a grain of flour, he says, when you get that far away. That's an early Christian writing. They're not cut down to nothing. And here again, but the contemplation of the universe, I said, had already an early Christian cut the early Christian down to times, and he felt that it was a salutary experience. Now, here's a vision of Paul, the second century, is survived both in Latin and in the Syriac, the Visio Pauli, and he says here, Paul says, Vidi totum mundi ad erat quasi nil in conspectu meo. I saw all this earth and it was like nothing in my sight. Et vidi filius hominum quasi nil esset, and I saw the Son of Man and human race, and it was nothing. Well, that's what Moses tells us here, remember, in our book of Moses. Now I know that man is nothing, which I never had supposed. So the earliest Christians were quite aware of the fact that you're not to be upset if you find out that this world is very small potatoes in the universe. The thought that this is the only world did not heighten man's pride, but it placed him at the lowest point of all, to which all things fell and to which he was confined. Which was the more pleasing? While the new cosmology, we're quoting Lovejoy, I remember Arthur Lovejoy, that book, The Great Chain of Being, which I'm on reserve here, he says, while the new cosmology provided astronomical reason for humility, that's true, we're very small, this was destroyed by the new cosmology, which denied life on other worlds, but at the same time provided a substitute for the glory lost in the doctrine of incalculable vastness. They always had this idea that the universe was very vast. The size has nothing to do with it. The fact is, well, it was closed. It had limits to it. And this is the subject of Coiré's book, which he calls The Closed Universe. Remember, from a closed world to an infinite universe. This, it's always assumed that this getting rid of the geocentric doctrine cost man his high place in the universe. The world, the earth is the center, therefore he's the most important. It's just the opposite, as Lovejoy says. He points out the geocentric doctrine does not exalt man. It makes him, it abases him, actually. What if the earth is the center of all things, as Aristotle says, then, quoting Lovejoy, for the center of the world was not a place of honor, it was rather the bottom of creation. Everything sinks to the bottom, you see, to which its dregs and baser elements sank. The actual center was indeed, what's in the center of the earth? Hell, of all things. If you want to go to the center, he says, you'll find hell. You'll get that in Dante, you see. In the spatial sense, the medieval world was literally diabolic. The nearer you get to the center of things, the nearer you get to hell. After all, the devil is the prince of this world. It's a wicked place. It's a nest of viper. It's a vale of tears, and so forth. In this world, you shall have tribulation, the Lord tells the apostles. Being a denizen of such a place is nothing to be proud of, and the Christians really rubbed it in. You have nothing to, you don't have to push people off the sidewalk because you have to live on the central world. That would put you in the worst position ever. But the modern assumption is that the discovery of other worlds older than ours and greater than ours would necessarily be a shattering blow to our pride. This is Arthur Clarke. And this is what he writes. Discovery, the idea of other worlds is, remember, he's the man who wrote 2002, Odyssey 2001, wasn't it? Not 2002. The second issue would be 2010, not 2002, isn't it? I don't know. But anyway, he wrote it. And so he says what he produced in things like 2001, Odyssey, is a shattering blow to our pride. Few of our current religions can be expected to survive it. just the fact that there is anything is so different from the conventional view of creation, world, and so forth. The assertion that God created man in his own image is ticking like a time bomb in the foundations of Christianity. Of course, it gets stronger and stronger. Huh? We will have to face the chilling fact, if there are gods whose chief concern is man, they cannot be very important gods. He's saying we're not important. This proves that we are not important. Therefore, our God who created us, and this is the only thing he created the earth and all that's in it, and he created death, and he's the God, and there's only one. But after all, St. Aquinas said, what glory is there in being a god over a lot of spiders? He says, we count about as much as a lot of spiders would. Why should God flatter himself to be a god over us? And Arthur Clarke's saying the same thing. But you see, from our point of view, we have already stopped the time bomb from ticking long ago. Here, Joseph started it. If there was a time bomb there, I say, he anticipated that. So the Pearl of Great Price would beat Mr. Clarke to it. Remember, Moses says, for now I know that man is nothing, which thing I never had supposed. And at the same time, Moses recalls in that first chapter how he has just stood in the presence of God. He's in the image of the only God. At the same time, that paradox. But by the principle of plenarism, we've mentioned plenarism before, the idea is that you can't get too much of a good thing. If God had neglected to create a beautiful world, which he might have created somewhere, then his creations would be imperfect. They would be lacking something. Something would be missing. It would leave an empty space against the sky, as the poet says. And so it has to be the most things possible. Let's quote Lovejoy again. The more essences, regardless of their rank in the scale, there are realized in the universe, the better it is. A universe in which there was no evil would not be so good as a universe, the actual universe in which there is evil, because something would be missing. You have to have evil too. All that is necessary, all has to be. Sounds like Leibniz, doesn't it? And then, so we're led to what's called today by Butor and so forth, the crisis of science fiction, for example. This has led us into interesting things. As the propositions become more demanding, they lead us into a sort of crisis. The science fiction writers have it too. The problem is that of the cosmos without God. Can we get the famous theologian Bauer writes on that, Himmel ohne Gott. On the problem of the cosmology and metaphysics. And Lamb in the religious implications, these are titles of new works, the religious implications of extraterrestrial life. Would the idea of extraterrestrial life destroy the image of the Bible, our ideas of creation and life and so forth? As I said, old Professor Larkin would throw you out of the room if you suggest another. That there might be another world, it would make you a science nut because the impossibility of it happening, that near miss theory, the conditions are so rare, so far apart, the same thing. So many things must be fine-tuned together that the possibility of the earth existing is more than once. It happened once, yeah, that was a fluke. It could never happen again. That was what the scientists used to tell us right down until the 1960s. Well, now we have this ancient idea of three levels, remember? Three levels, three L's. Remember we talked about light, dark light. We have the three periods. There is the past, pre-existence, the present, and the future, the hereafter. And every religion takes all three into account, except most religions reject number one, a pre-existence. Christians do and so forth, which makes it faulty and defective. It seems that only our religion has light, light, light. Light before we came here, light here, as Adam and Eve were told, you can enjoy yourself here if you follow instructions and you can live forever in eternal happiness hereafter. That's a wonderful arrangement. Why don't you find it in more religions? It's an interesting thing. The simple word answers that, it's revelation. But the ancient idea of three levels, incidentally, this is a plurality of worlds too, with the world above and the world between and the world following. What's the old English word for world? Midgard, the middle earth. A guard is a garod, it's a thing with a fence around it. A guard around it. A guard is a fence. Garden, a word of God. A garth is an enclosed place and so forth. Russian word for city is garod, Novgorod and so forth. It's anything within an enclosure. So we're living in the middle enclosure, and there's a heavenly enclosure above, and there's hell down below, the other below. And all three follow the same pattern. This is fixed in the Babylonian system. It was first pointed out in the hierocentric, it's the hierocentric order, the Babylonian temples. as in the Enuma Elish. A temple here is a duplicate of what's above, and what's below is a duplicate of what is here. The rule of the three levels. What was that Jesuit's name? Just a second. Well, with the world above, below, and between, they follow the same. Now, this is treated, Father Spillers, an Egyptologist, a famous Egyptologist, Louis Spillers, a Belgian Jesuit, takes the Egyptians to task for accepting worlds above and worlds, other worlds than this. He says, that's absurd. That's a derangement of their brains, he says. And he says, while the Egyptians think of a real life elsewhere in the universe and hereafter, now we're quoting, this is the official Christian position that's taken by the Roman Church, the Christians forget all of that. They seek only and exclusively for the vision, if not the possession of God, the mystic vision. That's a beatific vision. That's all you can expect hereafter. For the Christian, there is only one creation. It is ex nihilo. And this is the way he defines creation. Creation is the incarnation, the materialization of God's idea of what does not exist. That's a good definition, isn't it? Because only God has a right to exist. As the Muslims say, anything else is shirk. Shirk means sharing, a corporation of anything that shares. And since only God has a right to exist, since thine existence, man, is a crime with which, compared with which all other crimes are as virtues, to have the presumption only God has a right to exist, what are you doing here then? This is the point. And so that is the crime of shirk, of presuming to share the universe with God, to share anything, that anything else beside God can exist. It can't possibly exist. But then you run into trouble here with the Muslims. You ask him what his credo is, and he says, "Rabbi Nubi Bilahi, I believe in God, Malaki, and within the angels, the Anbiya'i, and his prophets, Ba'abil Rusulihi, and his Rusulihi, yes, his messengers, his apostles, his messengers, his missionaries, the Kutubi, and in his books, in the holy books." And you say to the Muslim, "Now wait a minute." You say, "God does everything. He is all. He's everything that counts." This is is exactly what Irenaeus said to the Gnostics. He says, "You're just wasting your time talking about anything else but God, because nothing else is there, and just say he did it all," and so forth. Then immediately he has to explain why all this evil came in, so he gets himself right into the same trouble as the Gnostics. But so you ask the Gnostics now, the Muslim, "All right, you believe there's only one God. You accuse the Christians of complimenting things unduly and getting things all messed up. Why do you have to have a father and a son and all that?" They say, that's outrageous. La yalada wa la yulada. He is not begotten, he does not beget. He does not beget, he is not begotten. And so that's nice. We've got rid of all that. Islam is much more majestic, much more simple, much more. Well, then what are you doing with all these angels? What are they there? And what about the messengers of the Rusul? And what about the Anbiya, the prophets? And what about the apostles that he sends? And what about the books? Why do you need them at all? Why don't you just have revelation if you'd have anything? And so they're in the same boat with all the rest of us. There's an awful lot you have to explain. You can say God did it all, but that doesn't answer everything as far as we're concerned. And the Egyptian is more realistic, actually, then, isn't he? The church defines then creation as the incarnization, the materialization of God's idea of what does not exist. In Christianity, no creature has an existence of its own. We're all just in God, of course. Ekistinos ad te, as Augustine says, inquietus cor nostrum donequat crescit in te. You have made us of you, and we're unquiet and restless and lost until we return to you and get reabsorbed, as St. Jerome says, until we all return to the nothing, and that's the word he uses, to the nihil from which we came, and we'll finally be happy. So he says here, the creature doesn't exist by its own right at all. What God takes consciousness of what does not exist by the intermediary of his creatures. We exist simply to give God an idea of what does not exist, because anything but God does not exist. This is what theologians get into. The whole idea of plurality of existence hereafter is vague and banal, he says. All of this is a poor and literal, and as literal and as concrete as the Christian metaphysic is abstract and spiritual. To talk about literal and concrete things, as we've been talking about, you know, he says that's a poor way to do it. That's The Christian metaphysic, he says, is abstract and spiritual. It doesn't touch material things at all. This literature, speaking of Egyptian literature, is created by people with a disease of the brains, brains which do not function like ours. They don't accept Aristotle in the excluded middle, for example. Well, this states the Christian position, to which Mormonism was a complete rebuff. There's more to the doctrine of difference than we suppose. But in the end, it's on these doctrines that our faith rests. And so we get to this LLL business, these three levels, and you ask, why don't other churches? This is the happiest one you could have. Why don't you find it? Why don't the early Christians have one? Of course, they did. But we don't allow them this, you see. We don't allow them any pre-existence at all. When you bring that in, they do allow, some do allow pre-existence, but it was a miserable one. It's dark to light to dark and so forth. But the reason they don't have this, of course, it's all in one word. It's revelation. And so this is what it all comes down to, revelation. And do the others believe in revelation? Well, here's some interesting quotes here. Revelation as a present reality. The first volume of the American Anthropologist, which we have here, has a scientific analysis of Mormonism. And it says this: Mormonism is a portentous danger sign, a monstrosity. This is a scientific journal, the American Anthropologist. A monstrosity born of deceit and bred in falsehood. A monster of iniquity and deceit. Well, what's wrong with it? Its precepts and teachings are not in themselves immoral. Reassure us. There is nothing immoral in the Book of Mormon, but its adherents have discovered the most dangerous weapon against the moral world order in the doctrine of a continuous revelation. A portentous danger signal to enlightened civilization. There is, says it elsewhere in the article, there is the cloven hoof. Revelation. Anyone believes in revelation? We have mentioned it before. Not long ago, there were those three things, revelation, dispensation, and there we go again, the three of them. Revelation dispensation and restoration. Those are three dirty words. You couldn't use them. And now, all the churches, all the journals. I have a chapter added to a book of mine called the, I mean, but it is on reserve, isn't it? Called The World and the Prophets. In the end of that, we cite how they've come around. It's called The Return of the Prophets, question mark. All the priests and the Pope especially are trying to sound like old prophets now. And you'd go to the stake for taking that position before, that revelation was possible. This was the position they all took. Continuing revelation, a portentous danger signal to enlightened civilization. In 1898, the League for Social Services included some of the most illustrious Americans. It had George Washington Swope. It had Jane Addams on it. It had, the most distinguished intellectuals of America in that time. And they all signed this. It was the League for Social Services. And they signed and published a declaration, 10 Reasons Why Christians Cannot Fellowship the Mormon Church. And the first three reasons are the most damning. One, they teach that they have the only true gospel. Well, if it's true, it's not like anybody else's. So how can the others have it too, you see? Because there's no resemblance. There's a terrific difference here. We try to gloss it over. Second, that revelations are still possible. We cannot forgive them that. They say we would like to fellowship, they're wonderful people, and so forth and so on, but as long as they teach that they have the only true gospel, and yet that's why we had the Reformation, because one group and another each claimed that it had the only true gospel. And they went to the point of making war on each other and suffering great persecutions for making that claim. We're willing to go to the stake when we have lit. Courage, Dr. Latimer, we have lit a fire this day in England and so forth because they were willing to go to the stake for the 39 articles, things like that. Because they believed, when the Lutherans began and the Calvinists, that they had the only true gospel. The Roman Catholics didn't, and neither did the other sects that were quarreling with them. Well, but the revelations are still possible. And thirdly, that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God. Well, of course, that you could have a prophet. Now, how many TV gents you listen to sending out their appeals for fun, they speak very freely. They throw out the word revelation. It was revealed to me, somebody will say. And they put themselves in the position of prophets. The huge corpus of anti-Mormon literature confirms the shocked reaction of the 19th and 20th century civilization at home and abroad to the story Joseph Smith tells of himself in the last book of The Pearl of Great Price, which is very important. That's the one we should begin with. This is to establish the proposition of revelation. If revelation is so, then we know where we stand on things like this. You can never prove this, you know. As long as you live, you could argue till the cows came home. The evidence would never do it, but you rest on revelation. The same principle of ongoing revelation is not only central to every chapter in the Pearl of Great Price, but is the only way in which each chapter is to be accounted for, according to us. Well, yet it can be shown that the propositions named above apply here. The early church had revelation is not disputed. It begins with an angel appearing to and conversing with Zechariah in the temple. Nobody had seen an angel for 400 years. But revelation was not a thing that could be controlled, and the church renounced it because it couldn't be controlled. See. Especially St. Augustine wrote a famous work on the doctrine of Christianity and so forth. He says, revelation, the trouble with revelation is that you can't control it. The Spirit bloweth where it listeth, and there's nothing you can do about it. He says, we must have revelation that can be turned off and on as a tap, that you can have, where you can have revelation when you want it and in any quantities you want it, and you don't have to have it when you don't want it. In other words, you will control it. Well, you don't control revelation, you know that. But this idea was something, so he said, you'll find that in ordinances, in ceremonies, actually. You'll find that in ceremony and authority. You can impose authority. A breath has made them, and a breath can make. A breath can make them, and a breath hath made, rather. Get that backward. Anybody can be appointed to any office under the sun, but it's interesting to note, since the beginning of time, no one ever became a scientist or an artist or a scholar by appointment. But you can hold all sorts of offices. You can become a president, you can become a dean, you can become a king, a queen, anything by appointment. There's some things you can never become by appointment, though we pretend there are such things. But St. Augustine says, no, we have appointment and authority, and then we have things that we can control, namely ceremonies and ordinances. That's what we do. So we don't need revelation anymore. It's very uncomfortable, he says. What we want, he says, is something multitudine tutior, he says, yes, multitudine tutior. He says, something more available and more, multitudine tutior, more secure, more reliable for the multitude to rely on, something that people can rely on. Revelation just comes to one man and so forth. We want something, and also says we want something you can prove. Remember, the Catholic Church defines revelation as three sources of revelation. They're the scriptures, they are traditions of the church, interpreting the scriptures, and they are reason, you reason about it. The Roman Catholic, when the Protestant Reformation came, they said sola scriptura, the scriptures alone, and immediately began to fight about what the scriptures meant. So they bring reason in too, reason and the scriptures. But revelation is not only out, it's wicked to suggest it. It has been until very recently at any rate. Its unreliability is apparent in the pastor of Hermas, who insists that God alone, in the pastor of Hermas, which was discovered in the 60s, a very valuable writing, in about the year 120, written in Rome, and it's valuable and authentic. You have to study it in theological schools everywhere and so forth. And the pastor of Hermas tells us that God alone can determine the time and place of revelation. A great inconvenience on the church, an intolerable restraint, which the church replaced by more manageable service and forms of observance, as Duchesne, the great Roman Catholic scholar, points out. We had to have something we could handle, and we couldn't handle revelation. And Danielu writes, in his book on Oregon, Danielu was the best Catholic scholar. He died under strange circumstances recently. Traces of that Holy Spirit who appeared in the form of a dove were still to be found among the Christian as late as Oregon's day. Notice, it lingered in remnants. It's what the Jews called, remember, what did the rabbis have after God ceased to speak to the prophets? They had the bat kol. Bat kol means the daughter of a voice. The bat kol. The echo. Bat kol is an echo, you see. It's just like a voice swept on the wind from a distance, but it's not direct revelation, not like that. It's the bat kol. And the same thing here when Danielu says, there were traces, just traces of the Holy Spirit who appeared in the form of a dove were still to be found among the Christians in Oregon's day. And Eusebius reports, he's the father of church history, that many events illustrating the immense hunger for revelation in the church after it was withdrawn in the fifth book. When the church lost revelation, a terrible thing happened. And I've written a number of articles on this, one in the Journal of Church History, in a book called When the Lights Went Out. There are three of them collected there on this very subject, so we won't go into this here. But Eusebius and Cyril of Jerusalem, the people, when they were willing to accept anything, so all sorts of quacks went around claiming to have revelation, and that undermined the whole thing. Pachomius, who was the real founder of the monastic movement, He died in 346, and with St. Anthony, the two founded monasticism in the beginning. He resisted the supplanting of visions by relics and miracles. He says we've either got to have the visions or not, but relics and miracles will not take its place. It's true they can be controlled, that's not good enough. He insisted that his successor be a man who had had visions. He says, you cannot succeed me unless you're a visionary man, like Lehi, even though they must send far and wide to find such a one. The man they did find finally was Petronius, who through his purity had been allowed to see some visions, but at that time the heads of the monastic societies were expected to have revelations, as Crum tells us. Cyprian rests his case against certain heretics on the revelations of a pure little boy who in a state of ecstasy denounced them, the last person in the world to claim revelation. But he had to have fits in order to give them the revelation. The best he can do for it is, as they use in the Roman Catholic formula, Domina Suggerente, God suggesting, the Lord suggesting a hint with this, well, of course, they say with the agree of the Spirit and so forth. But the recent statements of the Pope include the astonishing expression revelatum est, it has been revealed. Uh-huh. He wouldn't say that very long ago. Well, this is the last of these basic principles we've been talking about, that revelation, they all rest on this. And again, this was a thing which you know was in the early church, which the Christian world denies, and which is now being restored.